One of the worst mistakes a company can make in performing a government contract is to treat its customer exactly the same way it treats its commercial customers, because the government is a very different animal. Tim Sullivan is a partner at the law firm Thompson Coburn and author of the blog, A Government Contractor's Ten Commandments. This week, he explores the fifth commandment, you shall document your actions. He explains why the concept is more urgent in federal than in the commercial area.
We have a different relationship when we're dealing with government customers. When you're dealing in the commercial world, you're governed by what we call the common law, often the UCC in every state. But usually with the common law, we have a doctrine called apparent authority. And if I'm dealing with you, and based on my dealings with you, I believe that you have the ability to commit Federal News Radio or whoever your organization is, then you're probably bound contractually because I was reasonable in my reaching that conclusion. That doesn't apply in government contracting. In government contracting, the doctrine is actual authority. And a long time ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the risk of dealing with an unauthorized government employee is on the contractor. And so what happens, as you well know, because you're a veteran, but what happens in this town is that you always want to do what the customer has asked. The customer's always right. We've been told that since we were born. And if a colonel asks you to do something or a GS-14 asks you to do something and they have a lot of power in their program, you do it. And you believe the government's going to pay for it. But if those people aren't contracting officers, if they don't have the authority to bind the government, you may be in some big trouble.
So how does that relate back to keeping everything in writing?
Well, first of all, dealing with the government, oral advice is always a risky thing. In every solicitation, there's a warning that oral advice is not binding. And people, for example, rely a lot on what they'll hear from someone at a trade show that might be with the agency or a buddy in the agency who talks to them about an ongoing procurement and just gives them some helpful advice, like price is the most important factor, don't believe what the RFP says. That's oral advice, and that is absolutely non-binding. Also, as I point out in this particular commandment, the government, we both know, has a revolving door. People are there for a while. Some people are career people, but many people come and go. I forget the political appointees now. I'm talking about people who come there after college. They put 5 or 6 years in at whatever agency it is, and then they move to private industry. And they may come back and go back and forth. We've seen plenty of that. But what happens when you're a contractor and you're dealing with a particular contracting officer and things are going well, and she leaves for whatever reason, and she's gone. And now one of the things contractors hate to hear is the phrase, there's a new sheriff in town. Whether that's a contracting officer or a new contracting officer's technical representative, because frankly, those people often don't feel bound or wedded to anything their predecessors did. And unless you can document things that their predecessors did and show them that that's what you've done and that's what you've relied on, you may have a problem.
And so it's as much documenting what you do as getting anything the government might say in writing for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. One of the best examples is when you negotiate with the government. Well, whether it's the negotiation of a contract or a modification under a contract or a claim under a contract, you want to document those negotiations. And there's a number of different – you take good notes. You convert those good notes to a memo for the file that summarizes what happened after a deal has been reached. And hopefully there might even be an amendment to the contract or a new agreement that comes out that both parties sign. Those document what happened. But going back to our revolving door, let's say we do that today. It's we make a deal today. I go back and I put something in the file tomorrow. Everybody proceeds down that path for the next 2 years. And then I go off on a sabbatical or I'm off or I retire or whatever happens to me. And my successor has to, there's a problem in the contract. And my successor has to go back to the file and see if there's anything there that explains why our company and the customer have been doing something. If that memo was there, it could save the day.
And could you document, say, something said in a negotiation and then email it to that person afterwards? Would that constitute?
That's another way to do it. It shouldn't be a piecemeal thing. It should be a comprehensive document that lays out everything. What will generally happen is when you finish a negotiation like this, whether it's a contract modification or just an agreement under the contract as you move forward, when you finish it, one side should usually volunteer or take the burden on of drafting up an agreement that reflects what was agreed to by the parties, a draft. And you send it and let the other person look at it, and then you work that out. That is what normally is done between two parties. I always think that I want to be the drafter because people tend to become prisoners of drafts. And while they might fiddle with the grammar and some spelling maybe, usually the substance of it is going to be okay, and it's what I've laid out.
We're speaking with Tim Sullivan. He's a partner at Thompson Coburn and author of the series Commandments, 10 Commandments for Federal Contractors, running now at federalnewsradio.com. And so you also mentioned the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act of 1994, FASA, and FARA, the Acquisition Reform Act. These are the Clinger-Cohen era laws that pretty much dominate today. And you said that they made the federal market less unattractive to commercial vendors. How does that tie in here also?
There was a misconception that FASA and FARA, the combined impact, and they were significant, I'll never underestimate that, but you can never understate it, that the combined impact would make the world of government contracting a lot more like the commercial world. Well, the fact is that these are such different universes that that didn't happen. However, what these two statutes did was they led to a rewriting of the applicable regulations, and there were plenty of companies, and the companies at the time, Tom, were the software and hardware companies out there who really didn't want to deal with the U.S. government, the red tape, the bureaucracy, the representations and certifications, and basically their view was, we're selling enough commercially, we don't need you. If you want our stuff, go to CompUSA. And that was a very frustrating thing for the government, especially Vice President Gore at the time, who really spearheaded this whole movement to change the world of government contracting. And once these statutes came in and the regulations were done, were completed, the world of government contracting looked less
ugly.
Less ugly. It looked a little more attractive, and people started to dip their toes into the pool because, as you know, when the government does decide to buy something, it can buy it in a big way, and that really led to that explosion of all these commercial companies coming into the government world, the government space now, and unfortunately, so many making the mistake that they can just, it's business as usual, we can do everything we do with our commercial customers, it's just a different kind of customer. And as you know, there have been a litany of companies, the long list of companies who've been hit hard because they didn't understand or comply with the rules.
Sounds like you've got a fire sale going on right outside your office. And so I wanted to also get back to the point about email, because in the column you mentioned something I think that's important, that email can really trip you up if you're not careful with it, even if you're documenting things like it. And I'm thinking of the suspension and possible debarment going on right now for FedBid, because emails came up showing that they were going to rally the troops and use heavy-handed punchers to take out an acquisition officer, destroy his reputation. And this is all in executive emails. And yeah. So when you do document something for the file or for the record, it's probably good advice to keep it strictly to the fact of what you want to document and don't add any opinion to it.
Right. As you know, Tom, this commandment finishes with a paragraph on email. And the rule, I would say, is a real simple one. If whatever you're writing would be fine if it shows up in the Washington Post, then I think you're okay. But if that doesn't pass the Washington Post test, it shouldn't see the light of day.
Because in future, say, court proceedings or just some kind of a dispute resolution forum, an email could show bias that you might have had or deliberate misinterpretation of what the other person was saying.
The world of email has become the treasure trove of litigators. You think that by hitting the delete button, you're okay. But the fact is that it's still on your hard drive. And when litigation starts and discovery starts in the litigation process, the first thing they ask for is your hard drives, and they're going to get to that stuff. So email is just such a treasure trove for litigators. Why would you ever put anything embarrassing in there? And there is a long list of big names, Martha Stewart included, of people who have been tripped up by putting things in email that just did them in the long run.